ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, to no one's surprise, Barnaby Joyce, formerly Nationals leader, former Deputy Prime Minister, more recently former Nationals backbencher, has defected to Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party. Well, at least it ends weeks of speculation, doesn't it? Even if it's probably been designed by Barnaby Joyce in the first place. He quit the National Party over a falling out with leader David Littleproud, but will continue representing his electorate of New England until the end of his term, and then he'll stand for One Nation as a senator for New South Wales at the federal election in 2028. It'll be a half-Senate election, and presumably he's calculated that One Nation with the preference deals might get over the line. It's no certainty. In a statement, David Littleproud says Barnaby Joyce's decision to join One Nation is disappointing, saying the Nationals had supported him through many of his darkest moments, and there have been more than a few. For his part, Mr. Joyce sees the move as all about policy and respect for Pauline Hanson, rather than because of the likely dearth of career opportunities open to him if he remained a National.
People like such as Pauline, I think I have a fellow traveller, and I have great respect for the work that Pauline has done. She has driven the political agenda. She has made us, when I was with the coalition, react to where she has gone, and that has been an incredibly positive thing for our nation.
And the One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, says the move means a welcome addition to her party's ranks.
He's a figure that a lot of Australians relate to, respect. He's been, you know, Deputy Prime Minister of the country. He's been across many portfolios as a minister. And I think that we're on the same page, what we want for our country, and it's great to have him on board.
Well, his former National colleagues, however, were less glowing. This is the Deputy Leader of the National Party, Kevin Hogan.
It's certainly, you know, a really bad day, and I think a really disappointing day for us. He's been a big entity within the National Party. So, you know, there's one thing to sort of say, well, I'm not going to sit with the party anymore. But to join a political party that literally now opposing us takes it to a whole new level.
Well, Barnaby Joyce's switch to One Nation comes at a time when support for the coalition has crashed to a record low. Support for One Nation has risen to a record high. This is according to polling from Resolve Political Monitor. That poll also showed Labor with a commanding 55-45% lead in the two-party preferred vote, an improvement on the 53-47 lead in November. Joining us again for tonight's Nightlife News Breakdown is Emily Barrett. Emily's Managing Editor of the Saturday Paper. Emily, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Yeah, good evening, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Well, Barnaby Joyce held off some time before leaving the National ship. Do you think he's orchestrated this media attention? No, I'll reframe that question. Having orchestrated this media attention, I presume he's done the numbers and thinks they might get up. This will be the second One Nation senator in New South Wales if they do get up. It's a half-Senate election, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, well, look, he wouldn't be drawn, you probably saw him on 7:30 tonight as well, he wouldn't be drawn on how he sees his prospects, but clearly thinks he's got a decent shot. You know, it's a long time now between now and 2028, but we'll see. You know, One Nation, as you've pointed out, is polling pretty much at record highs at the moment. I think it was 14% or so on the latest Resolve poll, and Hanson herself obviously sees Joyce as someone who can really boost the party. So, you know, we've got these comparisons already floating around that he has sort of encouraged himself. You know, people like Nigel Farage, I think he was just saying, he says he's far better looking. But, you know, the question is between now and then, there's a lot of space. Is there room at the top of the party for two massive egos, as we've got with Hanson, obviously, and Barnaby Joyce? And we remember that Mark Latham didn't travel too well, butting heads.
He didn't last long, did he? No, that's true.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, they say a week's a long time in politics. Well, you know, we've got a fair amount of time to wait on this one. And, you know, nobody's ready to confirm any kind of leadership agreement. So we had some reporting from Mike Seckham a couple of weeks ago, speaking to the Chief of Staff, James Ashby, about, you know, these fairly well-developed plans to boost the party for One Nation and to expand its membership, and actually had hinted at there being more big names to come. Now, that seems to have been tamped down by Pauline Hanson more recently. She has seemed to sort of quash speculation that there might be anyone else coming to join. But if there's not a leadership prospect for Barnaby Joyce, or if indeed she's looking to hang on a bit longer, you sort of wonder what's the real motivation here.
Yes, well, I suppose one motivation is that I mean, he was unlikely to rise beyond backbencher status in the Nationals, ever was he? I mean, he's now guaranteed as a parliamentary salary until 2028.
Yeah.
Even though the people that elected him did not elect him as a One Nation member, they elected him as a member of the National Party. Mm-hmm. And some might say, and this has happened many times, I know, but ethically might some might say, well, then his only proper course was to resign. Well, he's not doing that. He's got an eye for the polls, but you presume that the rise for One Nation has a lot more to do with the turmoil in the Liberal National ranks at present than outright support for One Nation, do you?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've certainly been seeing some support, you know, basically been shed by the coalition going to One Nation. We've got Labor's primary votes up; it's around 35% now, and One Nation also rose up to 14%, as we said before. But the coalition primary votes actually fallen 3 percentage points in a month, so it's down at 26 now. So, you know, support for the two respectively, the coalition and One Nation, is the lowest and the highest in the history of Resolve. And you can tell that One Nation's obviously seeking, you know, seizing this kind of moment to exploit unrest. There's been a lot of questions over whether Pauline Hanson can capture the zeitgeist at this point to really sort of boost her. Well, I mean, she's putting her bigotry way out there, right? We've seen more commentary about high immigration and a shortage of housing. We know that the coalition itself made that link in the last election. So, you know, you can tell that there's some concerns being from the coalition expressed, and it's coming out in policy terms. We're seeing it constantly about, you know, their lack of popularity relative to One Nation. But, I mean, let's also remember, this is when we're talking about the motivations here. There's a clear motivation for Pauline Hanson as well. She's had, I think the AFR was reporting, she's had a salary boost, obviously, from having a fifth member in the party. That's another $100,000 a year for Pauline Hanson, and obviously, you know, the benefit to Barnaby Joyce of keeping on his salary going.
Yes, exactly. All right, look, to the controversy over the travels and related expenditures by Labor's Communications and Sports Minister, Annika Wells. Now, the opposition's demanding reforms to expense rules as well as an inquiry into Ms. Wells' spending amid further revelations about her family travel expenses. Now, to be clear here, there is no suggestion that Annika Wells has broken any rules. She's fully declared all expenses, and there are clear provisions for funds to be provided for family reunion travel for working ministers, and indeed these are all approved by an independent monitor. But they do amount to a considerable list. There's the $100,000 we spoke about last week for the minister's staff and a public servant to fly to New York to attend the United Nations in September, which prompted many here on the program to say they need a new travel agent, if that's and what they're being charged for airfares. Although others said, look, you know, it was a last-minute thing and it wasn't as far from the mark as you might think. There was $3,600 for the three-day trip to Adelaide in June, which some say coincided with a friend's birthday party, as well as a bill to taxpayers for family reunion expenses to take a family. They took a family on a trip to Thredbo, where the family did ski while she undertook meetings with Paralympics Australia. No one's suggesting that she shouldn't have been in Thredbo and she didn't work when she was there. Almost $9,000 spent on family reunion entitlements so her husband could attend three AFL grand finals. Well, there would have been a lot of Pollies in the crowd.
Yes,
I don't know that she was the only one there. She also claimed for herself and husband to attend the Australian Grand Prix in Melbourne and so on. She made three trips to Europe in the past year as sports minister, to the Paris Olympics and Paralympics, well, you'd expect her to go, and to the Rugby World Cup. No surprises there. Well, the criticism has been hot and strong from the opposition as well as some media commentators. Liberal Senator Jane Hume, who agrees the spending is within the rules, but implies that the minister did push the envelope.
There should be opportunities for families to reunite where it's appropriate, but it's when it seems that those rules are being taken advantage of. This isn't just an opportunistic night to bring your family to Canberra. This is events like Grand Prix and cricket. That just doesn't seem to pass the pub test.
And Barnaby Joyce, hey, why leave him alone? Had a similar stance.
So $1,700 for a night on the tiles does not pass the pub test.
Well, Barnaby would know, I presume.
Ask if a Wagyu steak passes the pub test too.
Emily, Annika Wills might be glad that Barnaby Joyce's defection is now hogging the headlines, I presume. You might think that Mr. Joyce might steer clear of terms like night on the tiles and pub test, given his form. But anyway, if you're a sports minister, you would be expected to attend major sporting events. Indeed, if you don't, you'd be criticised, no doubt. If you're the communications minister, bringing in a world-first social media ban under 16s, well, attending the UN to tell the world about it seems reasonable. Emily, I don't know, is it... These things never go down well with voters, and rightly so, because voters don't get the same thing. If a truckie, you know, is doing the overnight from Melbourne to Brisbane, he doesn't get his employer doesn't fly his family up for the night. So, look, they are perks, plain and simple. They are perks available to politicians. They're available to all politicians. She would not be the only one. Why the pile in on her, do you think?
Oh, look, it's hard to say exactly what's going on now. This is an unfortunate, to put it mildly, moment for Albanese and the Labor government at a time when they're trying to sell what is a world-first social media ban for kids under 16. So it's a little bit of difficult timing for them. And, you know, if we were to get our conspiracy caps on, we might say, you know, this is an interesting set of timing. But
well, is it coincidental? I mean, that occurred to me. It's very coincidental, isn't it, that the data mining companies, the tech companies who are having a bad week because of the social media ban, they wouldn't like this. They might think, have they thought, you put the slipper into us, we'll put it into you?
I don't want to stir that one too hard, because I think that these sorts of investigations, or I guess this kind of curiosity has been running for a while about Annika Wells's, you know, her expenditures. And I think actually there's a certain amount of it that's also down to every sports minister who is seen to be going to events that people want to go to.
Of course.
You know, these events are popular, they're really difficult to get tickets to, they're expensive, you know, there's a lot to be said about. That is optically pretty tough.
The Prime Minister was at the grand final. I saw him on telly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, look, she's far from being the only one to go, right?
Opposition leader was there too.
Yep, for sure. And I think that's the point, that as somebody who is representing Australia and representing sort of her portfolio, people don't tend to draw that distinction and say, okay, maybe she's supposed to be there. You know, as we know, she is actually required to be at a lot of these events, and she's certainly given all kinds of reasons to go. The difficulty is, and there are, I guess, a few things that have rankled, at least in the coverage that we've seen, and I don't want to overstate how voters feel about it, because we're yet to really see that, although these are the kinds of things that are easy to seize upon. But, you know, there's the fact that there's the frequency of events, there's the sums that we're looking at, and there's the use of family entitlements. Now, each of those things, as we said, there are a lot of sporting events. She's expected to attend a lot of them. The family entitlements are meant to help MPs stay connected with their families. So, you know, we're not to say that these should be misused. But,
and she has twin boys,
yeah,
who are small, and a slightly older daughter.
Exactly.
She's got three kids.
Yeah,
who would need to see their mother, presumably.
Exactly. And I think there's, you know, if we get down to it, and I think Andrew Lee was saying something similar today, at a time when we're trying to attract younger people, and particularly young women, to public service, cutbacks to family entitlements could be really counterproductive. I know the coalition is pushing for reforms to these laws, and maybe they do need to be reforms, or at least some caps or stricter guidelines put on them. That makes absolute sense to just think about that. But, you know, the point that we're trying to make here is, as Tanya Plibersek, I believe, said today, you know, this isn't a 9-to-5 job. This takes up weekends, particularly if you're in that sporting minister role. Now, admittedly, she wanted to hang on to that. This is a portfolio that meant something to her. But, you know, at the same time, it's not quite as clear-cut as saying, well, each of these things is unwarranted.
That's right. As I said, look, you know, ordinary people hate these things, and rightly so, because they don't get them. But I tell you what, the correct thing would be to say, let's change the rules. And you know what? You blow me down with a feather if the rules are changed, because the opposition may be enjoying the fun, but they won't change the rules either.
Because, well, I mean, as we know, there are precedents for people to pay these things back too. Tony Burke had to do it a little while ago. As we've also seen, you know, Bridget McKenzie, when she was in the same role, there was a lot of focus on her travel. I believe there were RAF jets involved and all sorts of things. So, you know, it's always going to raise controversy, and maybe there should be stricter guidelines put in place, particularly at, you know, it's the optics, right? This is a terrible time.
Of course.
With cost of living rising so much to be doing
looks bad. And you know, fair enough, you have to cop it. All right, to larger budgetary matters, Treasurer Jim Chalmers announcing today the federal government's energy bill rebates are not going to continue. This is more serious. He addressed the media in preparation for the upcoming mid-year budget update, which he said would include savings and difficult decisions.
There have been three rounds of electricity bill rebates, and there won't be a fourth. The Commonwealth has spent almost $7 billion on these three rounds of energy bill rebates. The states and territories have kicked in another $1.5 billion or so.
He also indicated that cost of living relief measures were still a priority, though, for the government.
This was a difficult call that we made as a cabinet, but it's the right call. It recognises the pressures on the budget. It recognises that there is more than one way to provide this cost of living relief that people still need in their household budgets.
Well, no one's going to like this, Emily. Are they hoping, hang on, it's a couple of weeks before Christmas, we'll do it now, everyone will forget about it over the Christmas turkey, do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, this is, in a sense, if you've got terrible news like this, maybe this is the time to be doing it. But when we say terrible, I mean, the timing for Jim Chalmers is, you know, this is coming up to MAFO, the mid-year financial economic and, sorry, the mid-year financial year economic and financial outlook. So, you know, that's coming up next week. He knows he's going to have to work a bit harder to convince people, perhaps, that Labor is the prudent economic manager that people are starting to accept, that Labor is actually the better economic manager versus the coalition. We know that that's something that Jim Chalmers has treasured as a legacy for Labor. But he also knows that, you know, spending is high. There are no surpluses on the horizon for quite a while. And what's more, you know, inflation's rising again. So we've got the RBA coming up next week. There's going to be some hard truths coming through from Governor Bullock. You know, there's not going to be rate cuts potentially for the foreseeable. And so all of this adds to pressure on how Labor is going to be balancing that cost of living and helping struggling households versus, you know, trying to rein in spending.
Is the Liberal Party attempting renewal at state level, at least? There's yet another young female Liberal opposition leader emerging. Ashton Hearn's been confirmed as the new leader of the Liberal Party in South Australia. She becomes the fourth woman elected to a leadership role in the Liberal Party in just over 6 months. This follows Susan Lee as a federal Liberal Party leader, Jess Wilson as a Victorian Liberal Party leader, Kelly Sloan as New South Wales Liberal Party leader. Now, I wouldn't put Susan Lee in the young woman category there, but the others are, relatively. Emily, it's quite an ascension, because there is perhaps a possibility that Jess Wilson might be able to win in Victoria, possibly not elsewhere, but coming up against Labor South Australian Premier Peter Malinauskas, you'd have to say that Ashton Hearn would be climbing something of a mountain. But then again, here she is.
There is no doubt that we have an absolute mountain to climb between now and next March, but my team and I are absolutely committed to making sure that we get to work for the people of South Australia and that we provide them with a real choice at the next election. We are energised, we are focused, and at the press conference later on this morning, I'll be outlining what the choice is for the people of South Australia. There's a lot of work to be done, and so on that note, we'll see you soon.
Yes, all right. Well, there's a lot of pundits seem to suggest that Susan Lee's head will be the next to roll, so we shall see. Hey, just before you go, Emily, a story in the Saturday paper on the weekend from Jason Katsourkas, your special correspondent. The Prime Minister's overseeing a workaround regarding FOI laws and transparency measures. How's he doing this?
Yeah, this is interesting. This is some reporting that Jason had done based on several sources, saying that the government is actually urging industry groups and peak bodies and major lobbyists as well to try and move their reform proposals that could be perceived as sensitive off official channels and onto disappearing messages. And that's the likes of Signal. It's both ends encrypted. And this is the kind of practice that puts really important policy documents out of reach of freedom of information laws. So there's just a question about, you know, whether this is actually kind of living up to the transparency that the government itself has said that it will hold to. It's kind of standard practice at some companies. You'll see, you know, you get the advice in large corporations to say, you know, transact things on the phone rather than putting things on public record or putting things in any kind of subpoenaable record. But at the same time, what we're seeing here is a government that had committed to integrity, that had made a big point of, you know, setting up things like the NAC. And seems somehow to be finding ways to really make itself stand out as one of the most secretive governments we've seen in action, really.
Yes, well, gee, the NAC's been tremendously successful, hasn't it, uncovering corruption, I must say. Anyway, that's another subject for another conversation. Emily, terrific to talk with you. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Great to talk to you too. Thanks a lot.
Emily Barrett, Managing Editor of the Saturday Paper.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.